Welcome to Amazon Legends, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became power sellers. Also providers specializing in helping sellers, aggregators that acquire sellers, and former Amazonians will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here is your host, Nick Urison.
Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. My next guest today has actually ran business development at Forum Brands, which is an aggregator that generated over low nine figures in revenue for all the portfolio brands. And today he's the co-founder and head of growth at Brandable, which is a profit intelligence platform for Amazon and Shopify. And when he's not working, we had a good discussion about that. He's a big time cook. And when I asked him his favorite food, he said carbonara. It was very specific.
There's a horrible New York Times recipe that puts tomatoes in carbonara, but I don't want to hear about anyone using anything besides egg yolks, pecorino romano, guanciale, and a little bit of black pepper.
Yeah. So his cooking and his daughter and his bulldogs and fishing occupy his free time if he has any. So with that, everybody, meet my guest, Mike Malasa. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you, Nick. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. So today we're going to talk about something that most sellers either don't pay so much attention to, or at least don't keep an eye on it in terms of how it's playing out, and that is the unit economics. So as it happens, whenever I take on a client, that's my first step. I put the unit economics in place, but then after the operation gets going, I look at the books to make sure that they match up. In other words, the actual numbers are matching what they projected. So we're going to discuss unit economics. We're going to discuss all aspects of it. But first, Mike, give us the description of what unit economics is and give us a quick synopsis of why this is so important and how does it impact?
Yep. Unit economics, Nick, it's exactly what it sounds like. It is essentially the profitability, or in some cases, lack thereof, on each individual product that you move either through Amazon, a direct consumer marketplace, or your retail or wholesale business.
Okay. So give us the line items of what is included in unit economics.
Of course. And I think this is where a lot of operators certainly need to think about going deeper. The unit economics of an Amazon business versus the same business on Shopify differ quite a bit, right? On Amazon, you essentially have your gross revenue, which is all the sales that come into the business, minus any sort of refunds, promotions, your sort of gross to net bridge. Then you have all of Amazon's seller fees and FBA fees, right? So usually 15% roughly in FBA fees and 15% in storage fees. That gets you to a contribution margin line. You have your advertising spend, and anything that you have contribution margin minus advertising is the EBITDA profit for your business, right? A lot of Amazon businesses run somewhere between a 30 and 50% contribution margin, which leaves you roughly that amount of room to advertise and be profitable. So if you have 30 to 50% of your sales that could be spent on advertising, you have to be looking at a 2 to 3x ROAS on ads for each sale to be profitable that comes from an advertising campaign. On Shopify, the unit economics are a little bit different, right? You still have sort of your profits minus your landed cost to get to gross margin. But the only fees you really have between gross margin and contribution margin are Shopify's take rate, which tends to be about 3%. Shipping can sometimes be a little bit more expensive using a 3PL than it will be on FBA. But in general, your Shopify contribution margin is going to be higher than your Amazon contribution margin. The challenge, of course, is that Amazon is a built-in marketplace with tons of organic demand, On Shopify, you have to scratch and claw for every customer to come to your website. So you can be prepared to spend a lot more on marketing. But the most sophisticated operators, I think, in sort of the challenging environment of 2023 are those that can use direct consumer businesses and Amazon businesses to play off each other, and those that really work to optimize the unit economics across both channels.
Okay, so I want to go back to the definitions, the line items. So let's start with Amazon first. So contribution margin is after everything is taken out, what is left? Or is it after everything is taken out except advertising?
Yeah, so folks use these terms a little bit differently in e-commerce. But I think the easiest way to run a business is to optimize around contribution margin being all costs before advertising is taken out. So essentially, all of your sales minus the sort of COGS and landed costs of shipping the items minus any marketplace fees, right? So in Amazon's case, those are FBA and storage fees. That definition of contribution margin, I believe, gives you the cleanest way to understand exactly how much you can spend on advertising and still be profitable.
Okay, so I heard you mention 30 to 50% contribution margin. 30%, I can see it's pretty weak. So give us your take on what people should be shooting for. But let's break it down. So let's first start with the gross margin. Let's discuss what should the gross margin be?
Yeah, I mean, it totally depends on category. I think the old joke in e-commerce is if you only optimize around unit economics, everyone is going to try to start a skincare or cosmetics brand, right? Because you can sell these brands at a pretty high price. The cost to manufacture is pretty low, generally small goods, so the storage fees are lower. So, you know, if you ask a Wall Street guy or a private equity guy or someone that only looks at spreadsheets, they probably would tell you that you need to have a gross margin of about 85%, which, you know, who's to say they're right or they're wrong? But that, you know, only applies if you're playing within a certain category. I think it's very, very hard to answer that question in the abstract because, like I said, a beauty or a cosmetics or a skincare business will have a very different gross margin profile than an electronics business, which will have a very different gross margin profile than an accessories or fashion or apparel business, is the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is gross margin percent is important, but also so is gross margin dollars, right? A 75% gross margin business that retails at $100 has $75 of gross margin. A 90% gross margin business that retails at $50 has $40 of gross margin, or sorry, $45 of gross margin to play with. So I think both the absolute dollars and the percentages matter here. What matters so much is not necessarily an absolute metric that I think sellers should be shooting for, but you want to have, I would say, at least a 50th percentile gross margin or better in your category. Right, you want the basic economics of your business to certainly be above the average seller, specifically if you're competing with operations that are coming direct from China, because you know gross margin is the one metric that every single thing is downstream of. So you're really starting behind the eight ball if you know your gross margin profile is lower than most. And you mentioned for contribution margin, which again, as a reminder, is gross margin minus any of the sort of marketplace shipping and storage fees before advertising. You're right. In most categories, 30% contribution margin is quite difficult because it doesn't give you a lot of room to advertise and still be profitable. But in some categories, that is just sort of the reality of what a great number would be, right? If you're looking at very, very large goods, for example, if you're selling on Amazon, you're probably going to kind of only have a contribution margin of 30 to 35%. So I think what's important is more how you're doing relative to the competition, and relative to how dependent your business is going to be on advertising. Do the baseline economics still work out for you to be profitable? So I know that's a kind of long-winded and frustrating answer, but I get a little bit upset when I see gurus who basically say you need to have 82% gross margin or a 45% contribution margin to be successful. Because yeah, that's true in some categories, but obviously, you know, every category and really every product on Amazon is kind of its own business, and the unit economic dynamics that you know, impact an apparel business that sells primarily through Amazon are wildly different than one that impacts a skincare business that sells primarily direct to consumer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you cannot dictate gross margin. There's a few things. Category obviously is important, but also I tell you what else is important. It's the size and the weight of the item, right?
Correct.
Because the absolute killer is get a big bulky item and sell it dirt cheap. I mean,
Right.
that's a real no-no. But what I want to do is I want to establish some because at the end of the day, you need to set some boundaries in order to have a healthy business model. And
Yep.
you cannot dictate this is what my gross margin has to be, but you can absolutely dictate what it cannot be.
Yeah.
And if you are building a private label brand, having a gross margin of 50% is an absolute no-no.
Correct.
Like any
Correct.
client that I work with, I tell them that their cost landed cost cannot be more than at most 35%, which gives you a gross margin of 65.
Correct. I mean, the one exception there would probably be, you know, luxury goods, but I think we can probably assume most of your clients and most listeners here aren't
Yeah, I mean, they're
selling
going to be that
high
much
ticket
far.
items.
I mean, 35% landed cost or less is acceptable.
Yep.
More is not acceptable. So don't go buying, getting something for, $4 landed here and then try to sell it for 10. You're not going to make money, period. So that's
Right.
one. The other thing is, I heard you mention FBA fees, storage. You also have to have the commission, right? Amazon commission, that's 15%.
Correct.
And then FBA fees is about 15%, roughly.
Correct.
Again, depending on the size. That's why I
Right.
mentioned the size, because if it's small, then obviously you can get away with it. But I usually allow between 12 to 16%. And so what I usually do in my analysis is I have three buckets in the expenses. Actually, I have four buckets. One is Amazon commission, the other is FBA fees, and then you have storage, and you have everything else.
Yep.
So I tell people that storage and everything else, stay on top of it so that it doesn't go over 5%. So,
Yep.
what is your take on that?
Yeah, I think, and it's interesting because when we built Brandable, we purposely built alerts into our system to alert sellers anytime there is a change to FBA storage fees. So one of the things that we do when we onboard folks into Brandable is we have them set up alerts for all of their hero ASINs that anytime the profitability either dips below a certain EBITDA threshold or is more than 10%. Outside of the trailing 7-day average, they automatically receive an alert via email and Slack. Same thing for FBA storage fees, right? FBA storage fees are, I think, the sneakiest part of an Amazon P&L, because Amazon, as you well know, will change fees quite frequently. And sometimes these won't necessarily come out in the wash until 14 or even 30 days later for an operator that isn't super intensely focused on sort of the unit economics of their P&L. So we've tried to kind of automate alerts anytime the sort of, you know, kind of profitability threshold changes. Like I said, when it comes to, you know, sort of Amazon's general 15%, you know, FBA marketplace fee, that take rate isn't going to really change. Walmart's take rate, Target's take rate, Shopify's kind of marketplace fee isn't going to really change. But storage for Amazon and the costs in a 3PL for a Shopify business are the things that will change significantly. So whether you use a software tool or whether you audit this yourself, This is a number that I kind of urge all sellers to look at on a weekly, if not daily basis. Again, our tech can kind of proactively flag that for you. But if you're kind of just manually running a business out of Seller Central, it's worth the 10 to 15 seconds a day to manually kind of audit the both the just sort of gross storage fees and the percent of the overall revenue that they're taking at both a brand level and for one or two of your hero SKUs, if you have a business where just a couple of SKUs comprise the majority of revenue.
Yeah, because these storage fees, you cannot really track those at SKU level, right? So it's the overall storage fee as a percentage of your sale. That's what you're tracking.
Correct. Although we in Brandable, you can track storage fees at the SKU level.
But I mean, unless like you have systems and everything else.
Correct. Right. You need systems in place, but the data is available from Amazon via the
Yeah.
SP API to track the storage fees at the SKU level. Look, if you run a very, very large catalog where no one product is responsible for more than 20% of sales, it's probably okay to look at it at the aggregate brand level. But if you have any sort of true hero ASINs or SKUs in the portfolio, you tracking at the product level, I think, provides a lot of value. And sort of knowing in real time if those storage fees change is important because if the storage fees change considerably, you may have to think about raising price.
Yeah,
You may
yeah.
have to think about dialing back on a PPC campaign to make sure your tacos don't run to an unprofitable level. And to your point, storage fees, I think, of the sort of P&L line items can feel the most random and unpredictable for operators.
You know, so going down the line, you have your revenue at the top, and then comes your refunds, landed cost, then your Amazon commission, FBA fees, storage, and everything else. And then you're left with the contribution margin, and out of which comes advertising. You know what's not included in this picture? See if you're gonna guess, which is hidden thing people never think about, but they're always re ready to go with it.
What you got for me? Chargeback, subscribe and save. Which
No,
part's the
no, no,
P&L? You got your OpEx, right? For a business, right? We haven't even talked about the OpEx of a business.
It comes right off the top.
Between your sales, so between your gross to net bridge and contribution margin, or?
It's right at the top. It's actually second level, right after your sales, before refunds. Discount.
I was thinking of promo in the for the purpose of this in the refund line. In
Yeah.
Brandable, when we show your P&L, we obviously itemize out promo and refund and return. But I was kind of for the purpose of simplicity here, aggregating them. But yes, obviously understanding how much of your sales are promotion led is extremely important.
Yeah. If you do this, like we're talking about gross margin, 15% is the difference between an acceptable maximum 35 and unacceptable 50. So if you don't really take that into account when you're creating your pricing, then you are going to be bleeding all the way, right? Because it's easy to offer a 15% discount. Everybody is ready to offer 15%. And you don't even blink. As yet, it's a big chunk.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing though is in some cases it can be semantic depending on the strategy you're running, right? A 27% product that never goes on sale is the same as a $30 product that is always on sale for 10%. So I think understanding, like at a certain level, depending on the kind of analysis you're doing, in some cases I think it's wise to almost like isolate promotion as a variable. And just worry about, okay, what is the end price that a consumer is ultimately buying my product for? And thinking about sales in that way. If you're trying to kind of like run an analysis on what advertising level can my kind of business have to still be profitable, if you're trying to kind of understand, okay, how reliant am I at on promotions to actually move units, then obviously you need to kind of deeply zero in on this line item.
Yeah.
But one of the things, you know, one of the things that we do in Brandable is we run a full basic price and promotion simulator. So we have a tool that essentially allows sellers to simulate the impact of a lightning deal, an evergreen coupon, or a 7-day promo, to try to understand, okay, if I drop the price or if I raise the trailing evergreen ASP, but then run a lightning deal, how likely am I to move additional units? And 8 or 9 times out of 10, what we essentially find is most folks aren't running enough price experiments, right? People are very hesitant to change price because it's, you know, feels like such an existential kind of core part of the business. But the reality is, like, for a fairly mature Amazon or even Shopify business, especially if you're selling third party, one of the only levers you have that is fully under your control is price experimentation. Right? So much of it relies on the whims of the Amazon algorithm or what your competitors might be doing in PPC. But constantly playing with the behavioral economics of price is a variable that you control. And again, 8 or 9 times out of 10, when folks use our simulator tool, they actually see that, you know what? Even if I don't want to necessarily drop my price, maybe I should consider raising my price 15% and then running a lightning deal. For 20% to kind of play with some of the psychology and behavioral economics to see if I can sell more units. So I think it's a good call out. The only reason I didn't kind of include it when I kind of did the full sort of breakdown of the P&L is I almost think of promo as almost living above the top line because ultimately it's just what are you actually selling goods for? And that is really the, you know, the amount that the customer pays at the end of the day.
I mean, the reason why I bring it up because the typical exercise before starting all the operations is okay, let's decide how much we're going to sell this for. And you make those calculations. And then, if you're doing this the right way, you are doing this ahead of time. You're studying the FBA fee. You are adjusting your packaging so that it fits into a tier that will be lower than the next one, and so on and so forth. So, you do all this. And in the end, you say, okay, this is going to be our price, and we're going to make this much before advertising. And then you go offer a 15% discount. Everything goes out the window.
That makes a ton of sense. And it's funny you say before advertising. Obviously, the elephant that we haven't, you know, the elephant in the room we haven't spoken about is the advertising line. And this is where I think things get the most interesting, especially when you're talking about a business that retails both on Amazon and through direct to consumer. The entire unit economic discussion we just had almost goes out the window in certain categories on Amazon because of how expensive the PPC system is right now, right? Like, I'll give you an example, right? Like, dog supplements is an example of a category where everything we just spoke about, you could have a 90th percentile gross margin, right? You could be selling the product for $90 and manufacturing it for $5. It's a pretty small item. So the Amazon storage fees aren't much, or the Shopify 3PL fees aren't a ton. It's a reasonably straightforward product. So you could be walking out the door with a contribution margin north of 50%, and you're still going to struggle to be profitable in that space because the average cost per click on Amazon is north of $5 or $6 right now. And this is where things I think are fascinating. Most Shopify businesses, Facebook, and to a lesser extent, Instagram is the outsource growth engine. Facebook and Instagram prices, there's a sort of derived CPC, but they're generally priced on a CPM. And it's generally based on the audience you're trying to reach and basically how niche that audience is to acquire. Amazon PPCs are derived from an equally kind of opaque black box, but it tends to loosely be a function of how many sellers are really aggressively bidding in this ecosystem. And to be even more specific, it tends to be a function of how many large brands with almost unlimited budgets are bidding in this ecosystem, and how many Chinese private label sellers are bidding in this ecosystem. And it's very if it's very crowded, the PPCs are gnarly. If it's reasonably kind of, you know, less kind of competition intensive, you may still see sub-quota categories on Amazon where the trailing CPCs are less than a dollar. So that level of variance to some degree kind of throws our whole unit economics conversation into whack, because you can do everything right from a unit economic perspective up to the contribution margin line. And if you're in certain categories, it's going to be very hard to scale a net new brand on Amazon. Or you can make a bunch of mistakes, but if you launch in the right category at the right time, there's going to be a ton of forgiveness, right? Like if you look at Amazon's search query performance dashboard and you find just the right trend that is like number 500,000 this month, but is going to be number 300,000 next month, and there's a $75 or 75 cent cost per click on Amazon, you might get away with making a bunch of mistakes on the pricing and landed costs and everything side. Whereas if you do everything right from a unit economic perspective, you find the cheapest supplier, you price at the high end of the market, and you still see some organic sales, but you enter in a category where the CPCs are incredibly high, you may have a sort of very, very difficult time. That's why, not to kind of extend this answer too much, that's why I think the Facebook Buy with Prime integration is so interesting, because with Facebook's new Buy with Prime integration on Amazon, sellers who have outstanding unit economics but are in a highly challenging Amazon advertising ecosystem can still find profitable growth by advertising off Amazon and fulfilling with FBA. Versus trying to grow exclusively via Amazon. So I think the world is changing a little bit, right? Like sheer Amazon PPC arbitrage is harder than ever. But if you know how to use multiple channels kind of in tandem, there's still some opportunity.
Well, okay, so you are advocating selling through your website rather than on Amazon.
Not necessarily. I am advocating having a, even if you're a very small Amazon operation, having a minimum viable website, right? A minimum viable direct consumer experience that's hosted through Shopify, so that when a consumer Googles your brand, at least you have a storefront. But if you play in a category where Amazon PPC is very expensive, but you otherwise have strong unit economics across the business, potentially running more offsite campaigns to Amazon, which can be done a lot easier now that Facebook integrates with Buy with Prime. And this is where I think, a lot of sellers have to get more nimble, right? If the PPCs in your category 1 month are $1.50 to $2, and you have a reasonably sort of low contribution margin and that not that much room to be profitable, maybe there's going to be more arbitrage opportunity on Facebook or through running affiliate campaigns. If the next week the CPCs in your category drop to 95 cents or a dollar or a dollar 10, you can start to scale up spend on Amazon. But the smartest folks that I've seen in the space are companies that have that astute understanding of the P&L down to contribution margin, but then are constantly watching the variance in price between Amazon PPC and the going rate on Facebook and Instagram, and very swiftly kind of moving budgets back and forth to support with, wherever there's the most growth and arb opportunity.
Yeah, I mean it's but there's a couple of other things also here, a factor in addition to the cost per click, and that's your conversion, right? So how is your conversion doing? So if you are converting well, then the cost is not as important. Yeah, so that's one. The other thing is you have the external traffic that you can
Yep.
drive directly to your listing. So I'm always suspicious of selling through the website. Now, with Buy with Prime, that's a different story because now you're not in fulfillment business. Because I always say this, especially if you're launching for the first time, it makes no sense to sell through your website because there are so many unknowns you're going to have to learn in terms of launching your keyword strategy, your replenishment, which is the most important, being able to project your inventory. When you start scaling, that becomes a challenge. And if you run out of stock, you're dead in the water, right? So there's so many things to learn about. Why would you want to also add to this workload fulfillment, customer service, returns, refunds, and all that stuff? Not to mention, that is the best case scenario, because that implies that you're driving traffic to your website and converting well, and your customer acquisition cost is acceptable, which is usually not the case in the early days at least. So that's why I always say at the beginning, focus on Amazon, and then by all means, put up your website, but use it as a brochure and building a mailing list, building a following, so that way you can following to drive traffic to your Amazon listing. Once you get to the point where you say, okay, I'm doing fine with Amazon, I can handle something else. Now with Buy with Prime, you can still launch your website, but still be out of the fulfillment business. But you still have the customer acquisition cost. So you're telling me that you can cost effectively drive traffic to your website?
Exactly. What I'm telling you is 12 to 18, sorry, let's say 18 to 24 months ago, if you were going to start an e-commerce business, you would probably make a zero-sum game decision around whether or not to build that business on Amazon around Shopify. And you would try to get really, really good at maximizing the unit economics of the one channel. If you thought you were well positioned to be an Amazon-only business, you would launch only via FBA, you would master Amazon PPC and keywords, and you would do that. If you thought you were a business that needed to really build a deep relationship with your customer, was maybe a subscription business, was maybe a venture-backed business where you were going to raise capital, you would probably launch only on Shopify to try to own the customer information, try to, in theory, right, enjoy the better unit economics if you could advertise profitably of not having Amazon's FBA fee. And regardless of which channel you chose, you would probably only grow in that channel for several years, right? Most of the last generation's great brands were Amazon or Shopify only, up to many, many millions of dollars. And then they launched on a marketplace or launched their own website. What I'm saying today is I would advise getting on both channels as quickly as possible. I think unless you sell a very premium product, I think the idea of folks going direct to consumer only and eschewing the opportunity on Amazon or other marketplaces is insane. By the same metric, I think FBA sellers, unless you're really, really running only a private label arbitrage, I think the idea of FBA sellers not throwing up a basic Shopify storefront the day that they launch their FBA business is kind of crazy. To your point, just launching a Shopify storefront is a lot easier than building out the entire 3PL and logistics infrastructure to go with it. So the way that I think about it is you have your sort of Amazon storefront, you have your Shopify storefront, but even very early on in the process, when it comes to growth, I think even very early stage sellers should be a lot more nimble in thinking about using both Amazon PPC and offsite traffic as a lever. Now that it can be fulfilled with Buy with Prime, or you can run like Amazon attribution affiliate links and get the 10% brand referral bonus back from Amazon, which by the way, isn't gonna last forever. Amazon's not gonna pay brands 10% in perpetuity for traffic, but they are right now. So, depending on the business, no, I'm probably not advocating if you're running a, reasonably low AOV product that is Amazon first. No, I'm probably saying it's not worth spending a dime on Facebook to drive sales via your direct-to-consumer site. But I do think it's worth investing in offsite channels, whether it's with the Buy with Prime integration or whether it's with offsite Amazon attribution links. Because again, the number of categories where there's still arbitrage in being Amazon only is lower and lower by the day, and I don't see this trend reversing. I don't think it's a bad thing, by the way. Like some people think it's a lot harder to launch a brand now than it was two or 3 years ago. And again, take this with a grain of salt, right? I operated a portfolio of mature brands and my job was all of our off Amazon growth, by the way. So I come from a very like that specific point of view. I ran the part of our business that was responsible for growth and affiliates and direct consumer and other marketplaces. And now I, run a software business. I don't operate a small brand. But I don't necessarily think it's harder than it was 3 or 4 years ago to win. It's just a different playbook. 3 or 4 years ago, it was about getting really, really good at mastering one distribution channel and dealing with a slightly more nascent infrastructure of software and logistics providers. Now, the software and logistics providers are exceptional, right? The like nuts and bolts of building an e-commerce business are a lot easier, but the cost of customer acquisition has gone up a ton. So you have to be, a little bit more nimble and willing to kind of win on multiple platforms. So that's the thesis. I think reasonable people can disagree with me, right? I'm sure there will still be some great brands built this decade that do it only on Amazon and maybe add a direct consumer component several years down the line. But like if I'm just looking at kind of the customers we have on Brandable that launched in the last couple of years versus the more established businesses, most of these companies had both an Amazon storefront and a fairly sophisticated direct consumer operation, even if they weren't spending money against it within 6 months of inception.
As you know, Amazon often loses inventory or overcharges fees. With Aarti, you can now recover up to 30% of your lost revenue at a monthly flat rate of only $99 with no commission fees for unlimited reimbursements. You can increase your bottom line. Their automated Amazon compliant process ensures hassle-free refunds. Visit www.getarty.com/legends and sign up today to get 1 month free and discover your recovery potential. I believe that you have to have your own, you can't just have a single channel operation and call it a business. It's too vulnerable, it's too risky, and especially with Amazon constantly shutting down listings, shutting down accounts, you never know. So that's why you have to have your own website. To me, it's just the timing and the circumstances of launching. Timing, obviously, you don't want to do it all at the same time. There's too much to learn. So just do it, one at a time. And the circumstances are, I would rather have a sizable mailing list of my own before I launch on the website. Because at least you've got a base of operations. You can put out a weekly deal of the week or whatever, and then some people will come and buy, and then you can add advertising on top, and you can leverage that mailing list also to drive business to your Amazon list.
So the easiest way to establish that sizable mailing list is to have a decent Shopify build from day one. Even if you spend all of your paid traffic to Amazon, right? Even if you try to actually encourage sales on your Amazon storefront, having an established sort of Shopify website that can at least put up a banner upon new visitors for email and SMS capture is kind of one of the core strategies to starting to build up that mailing list.
What do you think about running things? I mean, I'm not against it. I am for obviously selling through multiple channels, your website and Amazon, but I'm not for the idea of launching from day one, website and Amazon. But what I have found is some companies launch their website without any e-commerce capability on it, but they run things like draws, monthly draws, and competitions and prizes and things like that, all offering value and ultimately pointing people to make their purchase on Amazon. But in the meantime, they're building that following, that mailing list by all different kinds of activities without really having anything going on their web, on their own website. What do you think about that approach?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting approach. The drawback is the obvious benefit to it is you can do all that and you don't have to worry about, you don't even have to talk to a 3PL, right? You don't ever have to talk to Deliverr or Boxtrot or any of the other 50 3PLs. Because you're just basically building a customer data and intent engine. And look, it's not unique to just small businesses too. Like a lot of the biggest brands in the world, a lot of Procter & Gamble's brands, for example, have websites that get hundreds of thousands or millions of hits where you can't buy a single product, right? They're just content education engines for the brand. They host a ton of great blog content. And then they often have a where to buy widget via Price Spider or one of these other tech companies that send you to Bob or any of their other retail partners. The secondary benefit of that, by the way, is most of these brands are in the Amazon Associates program. So they're actually getting affiliate traffic on their own sales. I'm sure you've seen this in the space, right? If you have a direct-to-consumer site, you send traffic to your Amazon storefront, you can become a partner in Amazon Associates and collect, depending on the category, 3 to 8% back on that sale, which is pretty exciting. So I am all for that. I think the interesting change, though, in terms of why I think it is possible to start a direct consumer light operation earlier than it was 3 or 4 years ago is, several years ago, it was a large investment. Even though Shopify and other tools existed, if you wanted to start a somewhat legitimate direct consumer operation, even 4 years ago, you'd have to pay for Shopify. You weren't going to use a Shopify theme out of the box. You'd have to pay a developer for some amount of custom code. You would have to get locked into a fairly annoying situation with a third-party logistics provider. And all in, you are probably going to spend tens of thousands of dollars to get things off the ground. And that's before you even learned any of the growth tools like Facebook or Instagram ads or Google or conversion rate optimization, et cetera. The difference in the market now, and one of the reasons e-commerce is getting more commoditized and more difficult in some ways, is the whole operation is cheaper. There are Shopify themes out of the box for $300 that look incredible. There are outsourced services, and I can recommend a number of them to folks if they're interested, that for $4,000 or $5,000 will basically kind of establish sort of a growth marketing infrastructure light for a seller. And then there are some new age kind of 3PLs that are very, very nimble in their minimum order quantities and are reasonably cost effective, even if you're shipping a very small number of units compared to 3 to 5 years ago. So starting a direct consumer website that can fulfill, whereas it might have been a mid five figure investment, bare minimum, just some years back, there are folks doing it quite cheaply now. And given sort of the importance of having that storefront in addition to an Amazon brand, I think more of the kind of Amazon brands that do well will at least have a Shopify presence that can fulfill from day one. The one exception I would say to this is folks that are selling in the more wellness kind of categories where the product is really like solving a problem. It's like problem solution brand, like, I don't know, like I have scars and I need sort of a scar tape or a scar gel. Those kind of companies might do okay with just very content-rich experiences. But in general, just given how much the cost of running a direct consumer operation has gone down, even though the cost of ads has gone way up, I think we're going to see more folks that have both an Amazon and a Shopify business, again, within months of inception.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the churn is incredible. So I was doing the study the other day, preparing some analysis, and I wanted to look up how many Amazon sellers there are and what are their revenues. And what I found is, as you know, so many Amazon sellers joining every day. And in fact, I think last year, I saw an article, 300,000 new sellers per day. So I don't know if you came across that number. But the reality is the number of what they call active sellers on Amazon is only 1.1 million.
Yep.
And the definition of active seller is a seller that has sold at least one piece in the last 90 days. So when you look at it that way, it's only 1.1 million. And we're talking about the US marketplace. And out of that 1.1 million, 79% is doing less than $1 million. So, $1 million a year. So this is not, that means you have so many sellers that are all small and they're just trying to grow. And you've got the situation where, increasing the storage fees, the FBA fees, and the CPC is going up. I guess small sellers are being pressed from both ends, right?
Yeah.
What do you think about that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. The first, I think, thing to think about is that, this is a power law business, right? Any sort of marketplace over time is going to have bigger winners and more losers, right? And Amazon is a mature marketplace at this point. There's a lot of, Amazon loves to get really excited about the percent of its revenue that comes from its third-party ecosystem, right? It's gone up to almost 60%. I think Jeff Bezos' quote is that third-party sellers are kicking our first-party butt badly. But the reality is a lot of those businesses are very, very large companies that are well into the eight figures and even some in the low to mid nine figures in revenue. I think that's sort of the first kind of important point to make here is that it's a power law distribution and it's only going to get sort of more extreme in time. The second thing is, it's like, contrary to what a lot of kind of sort of gurus will tell you, this isn't supposed to be easy, right? Like, the idea that FBA or e-commerce drop shipping or even building sort of an e-commerce brand was ever going to be a get rich scheme that was going to be easy is one of the more cynical ideas that was ever peddled. There's really no business that's more difficult in many ways than consumer packaged goods because you're dealing with real tangible items. And even though Amazon makes things as easy as possible, it's a hard business. And most folks won't find scale, and there's going to be a sort of a great combination of luck and skill that goes into being one of those accounts that can clear $1 million. But the last kind of more optimistic point I'll make is the same one I made before. So again, several years ago, my opinion is that being really good at e-commerce was basically being really good at arbitrage, right? You were really good with navigating a nascent FBA ecosystem and sort of a very early Amazon third-party tool and finding efficiencies in keywords and unit economics and landed costs. Or you were really, really good at throwing up a Shopify website and running Facebook ads. The reality is that most of those things are commoditized now. So what is it going to take to be an outstanding sort of e-commerce entity? It's going to take building great products, having great unit economics, and building great brand stories around them. So even though doing those three things is exceptionally hard, the playbook in some ways has never been more straightforward. It's just very difficult to execute. But personally, I think the e-commerce ecosystem is going to be healthier if the best products and best brands rise to the top, rather than the people that are the best at exploiting Amazon and Facebook algorithms.
I mean, I agree. There's something I want to tell you. So it was in 2007, 16 years ago now. I think it's was about 2007. I was reading this article in Business Week, and at the time, there's no private label. It's mostly online arbitrage, people reselling well-known brands, and a lot of third-party sellers, of course, doing arbitrage, and they were doing their own fulfillment. There was FBA, but it was not really, it was very new. So this article was about raising the standards of small sellers. I take it back. There was no FBA at the time. And Amazon was doing one day, 2 day shipping. So this article was advocating for raising the standards of how quickly these third-party sellers could ship products sold on Amazon. And it was all about, building infrastructure, blah, blah. And we are going to encourage the third-party sellers to also meet the same standard. And I laughed. Good luck, I thought. Keep dreaming. Small sellers will do everything to save a penny. And they're not going to be customer-centric with billions of dollars in the bank that you get from other people's pockets, right? By going public. So I laughed. But then they released the FBA service where they said to the sellers, we'll do the fulfillment, will offer the same standard, and you just need to worry about selling more. So what I'm getting at is we didn't know this was going on under the surface, and Amazon was planning that. And I think that I've had a couple of former Amazonians on the podcast, and they said something to me about small sellers, that what's happening out there is, just as you said, because it's hard to do this, it's becoming only a few sellers doing extremely well, and then the others are disappearing. So, and the ones disappearing don't have access to technology, resources, or whatever. So Amazon is now bringing out more and more and more tools to support those small sellers. So there is this movement by Amazon to make more things available to small sellers so that they can increase, they can be more successful. Because otherwise, centralized power, centralized revenue stream, it never works in the long run. That's why this company is so strong, right?
And that's why I'm sure other guests of yours have said this, but the search query performance dashboard is really a pretty incredible thing that Amazon has released, as is the broader product opportunity explorer, right? If you think about before Amazon released these tools, there were companies like Helium 10 and Jungle Scout and others that were kind of trying to scrape this data for the long tail of the market. But the reality is all of the really large sellers, whether they were, you know, large corporate entities or sophisticated multiple time entrepreneurs or what have you, they all had their own kind of very expensive market research systems for trying to understand trends. Amazon, to their credit, has democratized that, right? Amazon has opened up its search data to the broader seller ecosystem, and you can access that in Seller Central, whether you sell a dollar or whether you sell $100 million on Amazon. I think, you know, other parts of the brand analytics report, like some of the customer demographic information, are equally as interesting. But I do give Amazon a ton of credit for, you know, opening up really the top search trends and search query performance information, because that is something that I think before was an arbitrage for much more advanced people that could pay to either, you know, access scrape third-party data or had access to large market research trends, that has now been available to the longer tail. And you know this better than I do, like Amazon has to do these things, right? The entire Amazon story falls apart if you can't launch and scale a business on Amazon. And the PPC costs, you know, being what they are is one threat, but you know, at least democratizing access to the data is a huge, huge step in the right direction for folks being able to continue sort of, you know, launching on Amazon. And I think it's even bigger than that, right? Like if I were, you know, sort of starting an e-commerce brand today, and I've, some of our brandable clients are very much built in this vein, like the number one data source I would be looking at is Amazon top trend and search query performance data, right? Because you're basically have a real time, you have a real time look into the consumer zeitgeist, right? You can see what hundreds of millions of people are looking for, and you can spot early trends. And who knows, maybe the right place to build that business isn't even on Amazon if the PPC is too expensive. But even if I was going to build a direct consumer business, the Amazon search data would be the first place I would look, because it's your best kind of view into what the customer actually wants. So yeah, I think it's a great point. And again, I think Amazon deserves credit, right? There's a lot of, you know, valid criticism in the seller ecosystem about, you know, Chinese sellers are overrunning the platform and Amazon does nothing. Very, very large accounts get preferential treatment, and all of these things may be true to a degree. But at the same time, Amazon is also launching some pretty outstanding tools that that even the playing field.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, don't forget the Product Opportunity Explorer, right?
Right.
On one side, you can see exactly what is bringing your product business. And on the other side, you can just pretty much look at anything and everything. Where is the business? And if you want to start something, you know, what customers are searching and how much volume exists, and before you do anything. So releasing all that data, that was a big game changer, because before there was very little data being released.
Yeah. And it's an opportunity for software companies too, right? Like we may or may not, wink, wink, be heading in this direction for Brandable, but Amazon has released a ton of this data, but it's not necessarily in the most intuitive user format.
No.
And it lives in these kind of very obscure silos in the brand analytics reports. Obviously, a lot of the legacy software companies have their sort of versions of pivots on Product Opportunity Explorer and such. But I actually think this is going to be a really interesting area for some of the software companies in the ecosystem. Like, if you can start to marry some of the top search trend and search query performance data with some of the kind of prevailing data around CPCs, with a really thorough analysis of category or product level unit economics. You can see where I'm going with this. Like, you can almost start to almost build a funnel for operators to understand if launching in a given category will be profitable. Like I said, it's something we may or may not be working on as we kind of think about the next version of our software. But I think, there will certainly be some really interesting technology built on top of some of the new tools that Amazon has opened up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's an interesting discussion. It's definitely, I mean, as we record this, we're coming to the end of 2023, December, and God knows what's around the corner in 2024. Unless there's another pandemic going on. I read something today that the CDC is warning again against, but who's taking CDC seriously these days?
Well, if you have a kid, I mean, if you have a kid in daycare right now, every single parent I know is sick. Especially here in New York, it's like the plague going around with 1 to 3 year olds, which isn't that different than any winter with toddlers. But if my kid's daycare is any indication, there may be another black swan event around the corner. But God willing, that doesn't happen. I mean, I think there's one important macro thing that I would want to point out here, and like, what didn't happen in 2020 and 2021 is we didn't get the sort of permanent black swan event that permanently increased e-commerce adoption by 10 or 12 years, like some analysts thought that we would. But what has happened is e-commerce growth has reverted to the pre sort of 2020 trend line, but that trend line was only ever going up and to the right. So the aggregate growth rates of our industry are here.
Yeah.
The broader macro around consumer spending and how folks feel about inflation, like who knows where that settles out. But I still think of e-commerce in a lot of, and this is good for Amazon on two fronts, like e-commerce as a share of overall spend in GDP is still kind of where like cloud computing is versus on-prem enterprise. Like if you're in our business, it feels like everybody and their mother is doing every purchase online. But there's still a massive amount of products moving through not just physical retail, but various types of old school means that I think will start to be captured by our ecosystem. Again, much like it feels like the whole world is on the cloud, but most Fortune 1000 companies are still running out of a server stack somewhere 10 miles away from the office. So it's hard to feel like the space is early when, you've certainly been in it for a while. I've been in it for a decade. Most folks listening to this will have been in the space for a while. But if you take a step back, it's still a pretty early industry.
Oh yeah, I mean, look, there's only one number that you need to look at in terms of where it is today and how it's trending in terms of how far this can go. And that is e-commerce as a percentage of total retail. And it's still minuscule and it grows in leaps and bounds year over year. And in 5 years, the amount of jump it had in the past 5 years, even if you take out the COVID situation, it's still huge. Before COVID, it was growing fast, and even after COVID, so there is still plenty of room for growth, and I don't see that going away. And also, retail doesn't know what the future of retail is going to look like, right? So there's so many things, and I don't see that opportunity is going to be, a challenge. But obviously, you have to know what you're doing.
I'll give you one fun data point though. I'll put you on the spot with a question.
Yeah.
There are several traditional brick and mortar retailers whose stock has outperformed Amazon over the last 5 years. So Amazon's been up about 80% over the last 5 years, probably a little more now, probably 85%. There are a few old school retailers whose stock has done better. You want to take a guess, see if you can get any of them?
No idea. Tell me which ones.
So there are a
Well,
few. One is Ulta Beauty.
ah.
One is Dick's Sporting Goods, up almost 200% on a 5-year window. TJ Maxx, and the real winner, Tractor Supply. So it's funny. There's still weird things in our ecosystem, right? As much as you feel Amazon's dominating, and they are, it's still a robust kind of
So this is
environment. This is in
very good.
stock price over the last 5 years. So it's not a perfect metric by any means.
So this reminds me of this book called Good to Great. Have you read that book?
I am not. It's Jim Collins, right?
Yes. So it's amazing. It's exactly what you're talking about. So what he did was he took these top companies in their industry where everybody knows about. And
Yep.
then he found those companies in those exact same industries, but nobody really knows about, except that they outperform these leaders over and over. And he studied the reasons for it. And that's where the book comes from, because he talks about leadership and management style and things like that. So that's why you're referring to. Everybody knows Amazon. It's the giant, except that there are others that nobody knows about. And one of those traits is in these, he calls them the comparison companies, these top performing ones,
Yep.
comparison companies, and the ones that nobody knows about, but they outperform everybody, they are the great companies. So that's why he calls it good to great. So how do you
Yep.
become great? And what he found was the leadership, whoever is in the leadership in those great good companies, top performing, it's always about the CEO. Me, 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 me. He's always on camera, everybody's talking to him. But those great companies, nobody knows the CEO. He just comes to work, does his thing, and it's the people in the company that usually are out there representing. So it's little things like that make a big difference.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I think, look, with stock price, a lot of it is that like Amazon stock has only grown so much, and it still has grown a lot over the last 5 years because, stocks are a reflection of somebody's perception versus reality and are driven by narrative as much as everything else. I think some of the reasons that some of the physical retail stocks are up over the last 5 years is 2018 was kind of the height of retail is dead kind of era. So a lot of these stocks got punished and now they've bounced back while Amazon's been on a trajectory. But yeah, certainly there are some leaders that have kind of cut through and managed to navigate what we think of as kind of older school businesses through the sort of transition to e-commerce.
Yeah. So, Mike, it's a great conversation. We can talk about e-commerce, history, future all day long. So, let's get to know you a little bit. Take us back to the beginning. Where did you grow up, and your ideas to get into technology? When did you start to show signs for that?
Yeah, it's funny. So I moved around a bit as a kid, but I would say I grew up most formatively in a town called Long Beach on Long Island, a little kind of fishing and bar town about 45 minutes outside of Manhattan. It was a great place to be a kid, right? I was like, 5 minutes from the beach. I could hop on the Long Island Railroad or the A train and be in the city in an hour. It was almost like an old school town where kids still kind of played like stick ball and stuff. So certainly a pretty cool place to grow up and go to high school. Professionally, I started my career actually as a newspaper reporter for a little bit. That
Which
business
one?
is a very, very tough one. Chicago Tribune.
Ah.
So I ended up working in technology. I went to work at LinkedIn, spent a couple of years there, and then went to work at an e-commerce software startup. So that's how I got into this business, which I've been into sort of for the better part of a decade now, at various e-commerce tech companies, and then on the foreign brand side, managing a portfolio of brands. So kind of a serendipitous kind of career, and I think it was fun, right? I think like one good sort of quote about sort of careers that I saw from Derek Thompson at The Atlantic is that sort of your 20s should just be for exploring, and then your 30s should be for doubling down on what it is you're actually freaking good at. That's kind of what I did, right? I worked at, four different startups in three or four different industries as a younger guy. And now I sort of have zeroed in on this intersection of commerce and media and technology is where I want to spend my career. And that's sort of what I plan to do.
What got you into becoming a newspaper
Yeah, it was
reporter?
kind of, it's funny. Like, I wish I could say that it was this sort of lifelong dream or whatever. The reality is, Northwestern was probably where I went to college, was probably the best school I got into that gave me a lot of financial aid, and their best program was journalism. And I just decided to give it a shot, right? And not just that. Like, I thought it would be just like fun from a college perspective rather than sitting in a classroom and doing an academic major to sort of be out in Chicago reporting on stories and writing and stuff like that. But no, it was funny. Most of the people that I went to school with, because it was a sort of well-known journalism school, had wanted to go there since they were, 10 years old. And I was there. I was like, well, they're giving me a lot of financial aid, and this sounded cool, so that's what I'm gonna do. But no, that's kind of been like, and that's microcosmic, I would say, of my career. Like, very little of what I've done has been some sort of grand plan. I've tried to just kind of take the most interesting opportunities as they come, and try to be as nimble and flexible as possible, which is, how I got into this e-commerce roll-up space and how we decided that we were going to take a tool that was originally going to be used internally and sell it as external software, and spin it out into its own company, which we did. So that's generally kind of been, it's been a lot of happy accidents, I would say, my sort of professional journey.
No, I think you have a good nose for smelling opportunity because they give benefit for journalism. You get into it, and then you see your e-commerce. Oh, that's going places. You get into it.
Well, it's funny that the really too. So when I left LinkedIn, the software company that I went to work for was a personalization and conversion rate optimization tech. One of their Series A investors was the New York Times. The original product was a media personalization engine. So it was kind of, this is really nerdy, but in the 80s at the MIT Media Lab, there was this idea to build the personalized newspaper, right? So like a newspaper that would dynamically adapt depending on your interests. This company was kind of a version of that. It was all about media personalization and trying to show you the most relevant news and everything. That is a very hard business. It will not shock a lot of people to know. So the week that I joined, the company pivoted to becoming a product recommendation and A/B testing platform for e-commerce. And I was like, okay. So that was part of the reason I got into e-commerce SaaS. I thought I was joining more of this like yield optimization platform for media, ended up being a lot more commerce focused, which ended up being much more intellectually fascinating anyway. So, and I think that's just kind of how it goes, right? Like, some people will get lucky and they'll stumble into what they were meant to do super early in life. Some people like myself, I think, will kind of bounce around and try different things and try to chase opportunity where it comes. And for me, that's what's energizing and fun.
Well, there is a saying, the first time you're lucky, second time is a coincidence, three is a trend. So I think you are a trend maker. So I think you are moving in the direction where you've got a good nose, and then you can see what is going to be a good thing, and then you jump on the bandwagon. I think that's the way I see it. I think it's very good judgment calls you've made all this time. So tell us, how can people reach you? And then you mentioned software. So if anybody wants to sign up and give us all the information.
So I know I've mentioned Brandable a few times throughout the course of this interview. I'm at mike@getbrandable.com. Brandable has been in essentially a private beta through this year where we have been manually onboarding select customers that we think can find the most value in the tool, primarily companies that have several million dollars of revenue both on Shopify and on Amazon. You notice that was a theme of this presentation. But starting in 2024, actually, hopefully by the time this episode airs, we will be open to the public, and you'll be able to sign up directly for the platform at getbrandable.com. We'll be offering either a 14 or a 30-day free trial. Still something we have to decide on the product marketing front. We'll be offering a free trial, and then the pricing for the tool will start at $200 a month and go up from there depending on the scale of business. But it'll be open to the entire Amazon and Shopify seller community. And yeah, I'm happy to answer any questions. Like I said, mike@getbrandable.com. Happy to run a demo for anybody. And more broadly, if any of the sort of ideas that we riffed on in this podcast are interesting to anybody, I always like to chat to fun people in the space. So don't hesitate to reach out, whether it's in regards to our software or not.
Yeah, great. I'm sure you will hear from people. I mean, there is a reason why we discuss unit economics, because that happens to be your area, your software, and everything supports it. And you have to stay on top of it. Well, great discussion, Mike. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Nick.
Before you go, make sure to sign up with Aarti and claim your lost revenue. Visit www.getaarti.com/legends to register. You will get 1 month free and experience Aarti's features. Sign up now at www.getaarti.com/legends. This brings us to the end of another episode, and I'll see you on the next.
If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the episode, and share it with someone you think would benefit from it too.